The Guardian.
It's now 5 years since America and its allies invaded Iraq, and the impact of the ongoing occupation on the world is hardly any clearer now than it was in 2003. The papers this week have been full of statistics and political opinion, but as a document of the war's human cost, it's going to be hard to improve on the debut poetry collection from Brian Turner, an American veteran of the conflict as well as a poet. Hello, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me here. It's an honor.
Here, Bullet is the name of your collection. It's a very impressive debut collection. And it's interesting, very interesting to find out how you came to write it, because your background is not one that would lead one to expect you'd take up a career in the army.
Absolutely. I studied poetry. I was also a machinist, putting myself through school. And at one point, I ended up following up with poetry to the point where I got a master's degree from University of Oregon studying poetics specifically. But this is prior to joining the military. Part of the reason, I guess, I think this is what it leads to is that to know me better would have to bring in my family and some other things like that. Because like any big decision, part of it was that my family, I come from a long line of military service. And so that was sort of the backdrop that everyone had served at some point. So if something I hadn't quite done and I was 30 and the cutoff was 32 at that point. So if I was going to do it, I had to do it at that point.
And it is something that tends to run in families, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
How, though, did you come to agree to serve in Iraq? Because I understand that neither you nor your family were particularly convinced of the case for going to war.
The other soldiers I served with were unaware of this, and they might even be to this day. But it was a very difficult decision, and it came up even to the last night when my mother did call, and the veterans in my family that I spoke of there, they were behind me on this, even though you would think in some ways that veterans would be, you know, do your duty, service to your country, that kind of thing. But they understood it. They would have backed me if I'd gone to prison, which was something I considered. But, for example, when my mother called, she wanted me to go to Perth in Australia because we have family there. And I didn't want to leave my country. And the only reason I showed up the next morning to that formation ultimately didn't have anything to do with democracy or freedom or anything like that or nation building or that kind of thing. It was really because of the soldiers. In the military in America, we often say the soldier to my left and right, like Fiorillo and Bosch and Joukowsky, sort of boiled down to them.
So now seems like an appropriate moment to read Caravan.
There's an old Iraqi proverb which says, no matter the barking of the dogs, the caravan marches on. Caravan. A long queue of container ships stand at anchor in the Persian Gulf. They carry 50 caliber machine guns in packing grease, dunnage, ammo crates, millions of bullets laid side by side, toilet paper, insecticides, light bulbs. The dockside floodlights hum with mosquitoes and malaria. Cranes hoist Connexes onto flatbed trucks, which line Highway 1 from Kuwait City to Dohuk in the north, just south of Turkey. With enough boxes of food for 130,000 meals, 2 to 3 times a day for a year, an army of commerce, a fleet of corporations with the Pacific as its highway. These are the boxes we bring to Iraq. Today, in Baghdad, a bomb kills 47 and wounds over 100, leaving a crater 10 feet deep. The stunned gather body parts from the roadway to collect in cardboard boxes, which will not be taped and shipped to the White House lawn, not buried under the green sod thrown over, box by box, emptied into the rich soil in silence, while a Marine sentry stands guard at the National Monument, Tomb of the Unknown, our own land given to these, to say, if this is freedom, then we will share it.
Caravan stands out in the collection because it makes your stance towards the war pretty clear. But for the most part, you've avoided any kind of direct political statement. Why did that seem appropriate?
I thought it was pretty savvy on the part of my editor, April Osman, and as well as Neil Astley at Blood X Books, because April is with Alice James Books and then Neil's with Blood X. But I thought it was savvy in the sense that some of the things that I initially wanted to put closer to the front of the book might push away the people I most wanted to talk to.
Who are?
The people who might disagree with me, and that the ones that that are very gung-ho about the idea of going there and toppling this dictator, and, well, he probably had weapons of mass destruction. Anyone along that, of that type of ilk, who might think I patently disagree with much of that line of thinking, that there were weapons of mass destruction, for example. Well, we could argue that there were, but those that were there were supplied by America. We gave them a chemical weapons and biological program back, you know, Rumsfeld's shaking their hands, you know, and then later we're going back a generation to go get them and stop them from using them. You know, it's just one example. But
so, I mean, have you actually learned that people that ideologically opposed to you have been reading the collection at all?
That's a great question.
Have you spoken to anybody?
No, not really. Well, other than maybe in a reading where someone will come up. Oftentimes after I'll do a poetry reading, there'll be a discussion period. And sometimes during that time, someone will stand up and we'll talk, you know. And it's good because those are the – I need to talk with people like that. And I think they need to talk with me, and we can – if I can open up and try to be – you know, I want them to listen to me. But at the same time, maybe if I can do that, then we can actually sit down at the table and learn something, you know.
So broadly, for the most part, the collection is about portraying the war as it is on the ground.
Yeah. But it's a subtle way of trying to it's still – now as a book, I think it still tries to do a the job that a poetry of witness does. There's a political element in the sense that and it's subtle, but by trying to bring in the emotional element, the people that I might not agree with, I'm hoping that these poems might affect them on a level that's very human. And adds, it's not talking headlines and numbers and different sort of the political debates that we constantly sort of we were burned out on and back in the States. People are sort of talked out. But I think poetry and art, a lot of the artists in different forms, by using their craft, I think it leads inroads into the discussion where we can look at this again and talk about it. Because people still, I find back home, are very eager to talk about these things, and they're very passionate about them and intense about them. But there's nothing new to say. So, like, what do we talk about? We've already sort of set our positions, you know.
But it's a poetry that also avoids any kind of formal frills, doesn't it? Would that have seemed excessive amounts of technique have seemed inappropriate to the subject matter you were portraying?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I wrote prior to the war, which was about 20 years of writing, I found that if I look back at that writing, I can see a very musical line, very long, very lush music. And I had more attention to that than the subject matter, I think. And when I was in Iraq, I didn't intend when I went there to be writing poems. And they just started happening as I was journaling in my notebook. And the poems that came out were, I can see now, but at the time I didn't realize this. So I would just see a poem and there it was, you know. But now looking back at the collection as a whole, I see a very different type of writing. And I think it was in response. And if I'd had those frills that you mentioned, it would have been dishonest to the moment in front of me, you know. Like it wasn't my craft skills that I need to subjugate my subject with. I needed to listen to the subject and let it be itself on the page, if that makes sense.
Yes. And now I was going to ask you to read Body Bags.
A murder of crows looks on in silence from the eucalyptus trees above as we stand over the bodies, who look as if they might roll over, wake from a dream and question us about the blood drying on their scalps, the bullets lodged in the back of their skulls, to ask where their wives and children are this morning, and why this hovering of flies, the taste of flatbread and chai gone from their mouths as they stretch and rise, wondering who these strangers are who would kick their hard feet, saying, last call, motherfucker, last call.
Body Bags is an unusual, or stands out in the collection, because of the fact that it gives a sense of the contempt that some of the soldiers, some of the American soldiers serving in Iraq have had for the Iraqis, and which we've read a lot about in Abu Ghraib. But that doesn't seem to have described, for the most part, your experience of American servicemen.
This poem is written directly, and getting on that point exactly, I hope. I remember there was a mortar that landed in our camp, and it killed – this is very early on when we were in country, and we had come to replace the initial invasion unit. So they were maybe a month away from going home, and a mortar landed in the camp, and it exploded, killing their company commander and I believe a supply sergeant, and maybe a company XO. And they were furious about this, you know. And I remember walking over, and I couldn't talk to anyone of my sort of equal rank among them, my colleagues among them, which is normal. But in this case, they didn't. It was very odd. I could only speak to people higher up the food chain, you know. And I did speak to one of their higher echelon kind of sergeants, and he told me, he said, you know, tomorrow I guarantee you there'll be three body bags outside the gate. And when I woke up in the morning, I found not three but two, and they weren't outside the gate or outside the camp, but they were right outside our hooch or the building that we were sleeping in. And I remember I walked over, and I was with my own platoon sergeant. We were standing there just sort of taking in the moment. It was a sunny day, and there was a couple of date palms right behind me, and these two men, dead men, laying there. And they were the first two – they were the first dead people I'd seen in country. And up walked two soldiers. They were maybe 19 years old. And at the one time when I was in Iraq, I was much older. I was 37. So as they walked up, I remember looking at them, and they did what they say in the poem. And I just remember thinking, you know, because I was beginning my time there. And I thought, well, I hope this doesn't happen to me. I hope I don't become jaded like that.
Mm. Yeah. Inside that experience, it begins to become more than comprehensible why they might have acted that way, although it still seems shocking.
Yeah, absolutely.
For yourself, you've made an effort to understand the country's history and culture and imagine yourself in the shoes of the Iraqis. How did you, while you were out there, did you read a lot of Iraqi poetry and history? And
I did. I had I brought with me out of King's College London, actually, an anthology called Iraqi Poetry Today. And I had that. And it was mostly expatriate Iraqis living, some here in Great Britain and some around the world. But I found it very useful. It gave me some insights. And plus, I just wanted to learn some of their literary tradition in the current mode. And I tried to go back a bit. I'm studying, broadening the scope a bit. And for example, I was reading some Saadi, Persian stuff from like the year 1258, that kind of thing, the Gulistan. And the people that I met, this is common among a lot of soldiers, though, this part. I'm not sure, but I know some studied literature and the history, especially a lot of soldiers are interested in history. But many of us, I found, would often try and talk with the people that we met. We were tired of each other's stories because we'd had guard duty or we were in the vehicles and you sort of tell every story. Everybody knows everything about each other's lives and you burned out on that. But Iraqi people were from a completely different culture and we're in this country and like trying to figure out what does this mean to them, what can I learn from this? And they have amazing people, you know, with civilization after civilization sort of layered there in the sand. And when, for example, one of the things I cut out of the book, after the first section, there was a quote from President Bush that said, quote, this crusade, comma, this war on terror is going to last a while, unquote. And I cut that out because of the reason I didn't want to push people away too early in the book, that kind of thing. But I remember when he said that, I was in – I remember thinking, you know, this – you have to be very careful with what you say because when I stood – history in America is very different than history in Iraq. And when I was stood on the banks of the Tigris River late at night, near dawn, and across this wide, slow-moving river, it's deceptively slow, though. It's actually pretty quick. On the other side, I could see with the ambient light of the city skylining the buildings on the far shore, I heard a pop, like a boom, sort of maybe a hand grenade. And then I heard small arms fire, like brrr, pop, 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 pop. Sort of, and I remember thinking, well, that's not in my jurisdiction. Basically, that's somebody else's business over there because it was out of our area, but it was close enough that I was very interested in it, and I remember thinking as I was looking at the silhouettes where the fire was coming from, I guess that it was a police station that was being attacked, maybe something along those lines or a checkpoint. At the same time, one of the buildings that was in silhouette is one of the castles of Salah al-Din. His name, it's hard for me to pronounce, but he. He's one of the people who's famous for the heroes of the day of pushing Christian invaders out of the Crusaders, you know, out. And then when George Bush says something like that, it's very, it's very telling because in America we conceptually talk about history, for the most part. But we don't have lots of physical landmarks that we can put our hand on. Like when school children walk down that street on the other side of the river in Mosul, they can put their hand on the walls of this castle. And so the Crusaders are very physical, felt presence, even when they're being driven out.
So a metaphorical allusion, casual metaphorical allusion to the Crusades is not going to go down very well. I wonder if you could read Highway 1 at this point.
This poem begins with some lines from a poet, Al-Jawahiri, and he wrote, "I see a horizon lit with blood and many a starless night. A generation comes and another goes, and the fire keeps burning." Highway 1. It begins with the highway of death, with an untold number of ghosts wandering the road at night, searching for the way home to Najaf, Kirkuk, Mosul, and Khan al-Assad. It begins here with the shuffling of feet on the long road north. This is the spice road of old, the caravan trail of camel dust and heat, where Egyptian limes and sultani lemons swayed in crates strapped down by leather, where merchants traded privet flowers and musk, aloes, honeycombs, and silk brought from the Orient. Past marsh Arabs in the Euphrates wheel, past wild camels and waving children who marvel at the painted guns, the convoy pushes on, past the ruins of Babylon and Sumer, through the land of Gilgamesh, where the minarets sound the muezzin's prayer, resonant and deep. Cranes roost atop power lines in enormous bowl-shaped nests of sticks and twigs. And when a sergeant shoots one from the highway, it pauses, as if amazed the death has found it, here, on 7 a.m. on such a beautiful morning, before pitching over the side and falling in a slow unraveling of feathers and wings.
So when did you actually write the poems? Many of them were written in Iraq at the time. When did you get the opportunity to write?
I wrote the collection as a whole was written while I was in Iraq, except the month I came back, I wrote 10 or 15 more poems, and only two or three of those made it into this collection. So the bulk of it, almost all of it, is from Iraq. And time-wise, I didn't write anything when I was outside of the wire, the perimeter of the bases that we were in. We were in many different bases, except for there's one poem. At one point, I wrote two lines. I thought them in my head as we were driving down Highway 1 south of Baghdad itself on a regular mission that we were doing. But normally, I didn't allow myself to sort of think that way. I had to be very focused on my job as much as possible. So what I would do is I would be focused on my job outside of the wire. But then when I would come back inside and we would have what they call downtime, we'd have to go work out or we weren't eating or whatever. A lot of times when we're really busy, all we would have is time just to go to get some sleep, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours of sleep or something. But I would try to make a point of it to take out – I had these college-ruled notebooks and I would write journal diaries, journal entries. And sometimes if you looked at them, you'd find sketches from overhead of a street, for example, with different depictions of where soldiers were during an ambush or something. But then out of those journals, these poems started appearing, and maybe a few lines here and there. And then I put them into another notebook that I kept with me, and I would continue to work on those poems. And then the journal itself, when I'd finish those, I'd mail those home in a kind of an odd conversation with my family back home. In the Leopold Scope is a poem that I wrote. Unlike the other ones, I was actually doing my job at the time. But it was a very rare time where I was up in a tower on the perimeter doing perimeter guard, which we rarely did, only for about 3 weeks at one point. And we were still doing missions outside. But I found myself for many hours staring opposite of the village that we were on the perimeter of, staring out towards the desert. And I wrote this poem during that time. And it's called In the Leopold Scope.
Which, before you start, I just wondered, what is the Leopold Scope?
Oh, and the Leopold Scope, the American taxpayer dollars paid probably a fairly good amount of money for this scope. It's on a small tripod, and the scope itself is, I don't know how to describe it on a radio, it's just a foot or so long. It's not very big, but it has a wide lens on the opposite of the viewing end. The viewing end has, it's a sort of scope. It doesn't mount like onto a weapon, for example. It just specifically goes on this tripod. It's more like a spotter scope, basically. And with this scope, I could see from where I was standing with my naked eye I could see the far ridgeline about 2,000 meters out, but or even further. But I couldn't make out. I could just make out the idea that there was a village off in the distance with my naked eye and maybe a road below that. But with the scope, I could see people in the village. I could see them walking around, the animals there, their cars, their clothing they were wearing, what they were doing when they go up on the rooftops, and for example. And it brought into that distance was sort of bridged a bit with that scope.
Because a distance is a theme that runs through the book. Is the in modern warfare the huge gulf between you and the people who are shooting at you and who you're shooting at?
Right. Yeah. Then that gulf is tremendous, and it's very frustrating a lot of times for an infantry soldier. The soldiers I served with, that was a very frustrating thing. For example, most of the time that we were attacked, it was obliquely and from a distance. So it'd be a mortar round with its own arc coming into a camp. And then by the time that thing was in flight, they were already probably packing up and driving off, you know, driving off real quickly with their car, getting ready to jump in a car and drive away. And a sniper from a distance shooting at us, a roadside bomb left by the side with a remote detonation from far away. So oftentimes, I think this is true for both sides, you know, whoever it was that was the sniper, the roadside bomber, they were being shot at by people off in the distance, just as we were shooting at people off in the distance. And very rarely was combat really close up, that kind of, you know, I never saw any of the kind of trench warfare of World War I or World War II kind of thing. So although there is some of that, does happen. And Fallujah, for example, is a big example of that. In the Leopold scope, with a 40 by 60 millimeter spotting scope, I traverse the Halabja skyline, scanning rooftops 2,000 meters out to find a woman in sparkling green, standing among antennas and satellite dishes, hanging laundry on an invisible line. She's dressing the dead, clothing them as they wait in silence. The pigeons circling as fume stacks billow a noxious black smoke. She's welcoming them back to the dry earth, giving them dresses in tangerine and teal, woven cotton shirts dyed blue. She waits for them to lean forward into the breeze, for the wind's breath to return the bodies they once had. Women with breasts swollen by milk, men with shepherd-thin bodies, children running hard into the horizon's curving lens.
Another of the collection's major themes is the effect that the war has on those taking part in it, the lingering trauma. I wondered, did writing the poems help you cope with the effect of the war, do you think?
No, actually. You know, I know it's odd because a lot of people oftentimes outside of poetry, and a lot of poets as well, that's what they find from it. But I didn't find it cathartic. And I think it's because of the situation I was in. I'm writing poems now about this similar subject, the war in Iraq. But being back home, they're very different poems. And psychology is different even in how I feel writing them and what that experience is. But when I was writing there, they were not cathartic, and I didn't feel like I was getting something off my chest. And I think it was because of that distance. You know what I mean?
It's hardly strong emotion recollected in tranquility.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I didn't have that tranquility or the recollect. I wasn't recollect. Although a lot of things were written from what had happened that day. So it was already some distance from the event. But the pressure of the possibility of death was still hovering with me, you know, as it does with everyone in Iraq, I believe.
Which I understand it's not so much the active combat, but the sitting around for long periods being scared that does the damage, the enduring damage to people.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of to be honest, and this is odd to say, but it was a year of incredible boredom, like mind-numbing, teeth-melting boredom, you know, but punctuated by moments that were just very intense and difficult to sort of get your head around afterwards, or maybe even during. But I don't know if that gets to your question.
and it's clearly something that you could see leaving deep scars on those around you as well as yourself.
I guess to pick up on that,
I mean, physical scars, obviously, but yeah, psychic ones as well.
It's tough because we went in, we crossed the border from Kuwait into Iraq. And from then going into the country at that moment, you lock and load a 30-round magazine, these bullets, into the weapon. You chamber around in the weapon. And now you're actually – it's not training anymore. You're going into a combat zone. Your life is on the line. Your friends' lives are on the line. You may make a mistake and shoot someone. You'll regret the rest of your life. Things like that, and a multitude of things that you can't prepare for. And right from that very beginning, the adrenaline level in your body is just pumping. It's very your body's under high anxiety. But there's no way to stay up like that and that kind of alert level for an entire year. At some point, you have to drop down a bit. But still, it's not like it drops down here. Very much underneath the surface. Yeah, but it's there. Yeah. Katyusha rockets. The 107s have a crackling sound of fire and electricity, of air-ruckled heat. And when they pinwheel over the rooftops of Haman al-Alil, they just keep going, traveling for years over the horizon to land in the meridians of Divisadero Street, where I'm standing early one morning on a Memorial Day in Fresno, California. The veterans parade scattering at the impact, mothers shielding their children by instinct. Old war vets crouching behind automobiles as police set up an outer cordon for the unexploded ordnance. Rockets often fall in the night sky of the skull, down long avenues of the brain's myelin sheathing, over synapses and the rough structures of thought. They fall into the hippocampus, into the seat of memory, where lovers and strangers and old friends entertain themselves, unaware of the dangers headed their way, or that I will need to search among them the way the bomb disposal tech walks tethered and alone down Divisadero Street, suited up as if walking on the moon's surface, as the crowd watches just how determined he is to dismantle death, to take it apart piece by piece, the bravest thing I've ever seen.
So do you think you will write about Iraq and the war again now you're home?
I avoided it at first, but because I wanted to write about other things, and there's so much to write about in this world and in life, and I had before. I wrote 7 other manuscripts, fortunately not published, because I was learning. But they encompassed there was a wide spectrum of sort of subjects that they investigated or tried to write. That's what I was. I wrote about labor, intimacy, a failed marriage, South Korea, Bosnia, things like that, and. With this one, though, I wrote Here Bullet, and then I didn't want to be pigeonholed completely. I thought, well, I've been writing about a lot of things in my life, and there are many other things I'd like to write about now. So I tried doing that for a bit. But at the same time, I was getting emails from the soldiers that I'd served with that had gone back, and I was hearing it was sort of percolating back up into my life. So I'd walk around, and I had sort of a normal life again back home where I'm not Sergeant Turner, I'm Brian. And I drive to work, or I'd go to a. For example, I went to a hardware store, and I was walking around the hardware store. But at the time, as I'm getting some nails that I was going for this project I was making, I had this email that I received the night before from Bosch, my rifleman in Iraq. Now he's a sergeant, and in that email, he talked about this village that they attacked, and they bombed it for about 10 hours after there was a there. The fighters put up a strong fight in the beginning, so the Americans backed up, and then we bombed the place for about 10 hours and then went in. And that email was much more detailed than what I'm just now saying, but the images that he had sent me and the story that he was telling it seemed important. And I was wondering, where is that in my life? And I look around America, and I don't see the war. I don't feel it as much, but it's happening on the other side
There's
of the
no
earth.
Yeah. Ticker tape parades for returning soldiers, is there?
No, but also on that side, I think there's a good thing that, soldiers are culpable for what they do. I hold myself culpable and responsible for things I've been a part of. But at the same time, I was glad to see that when I arrived, it wasn't like Vietnam where people were spitting at soldiers. That type of reception hasn't been there. when we landed in Maine, we had to clear customs. It's just some formality they have to do, which seemed like a waste of money, but we had to do this. And as I walked through, it was very late at night, but there were World War II veterans, these couples that had stayed up late, and they do shifts there, and they just shake your hand. They don't say anything political. They just say, you know, welcome home. Good, glad you're back, that kind of thing. And it was a very kind reception.
So, well, I'm glad somebody turned out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very glad that you wrote this collection. The best way to end this podcast, after having thanked you very much for coming in, seems to be with your words.
To sand. To sand go tracers and ball ammunition. To sand the green smoke goes, each finned mortar spinning in light, each star cluster bursting above. To sand go the skeletons of war, year by year. To sand go the reticles of the brain, the minarets and steeple bells, brackish sludge from the open sewers, trash fires, the silent cowbirds resting on the shoulders of a yak. To sand, each head of cabbage unravels its leaves, the way dreams burn in the oil fires of night.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.